Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, July 9th. We begin with some articles out of the Decatur Herald and Review. Our first is a H&R staff report with the headline, Decatur Man Arraigned in Armed Robbery Case. A 20-year-old Decatur man was arraigned Wednesday on three felony charges, including a Class X armed robbery charge for allegedly shooting a 23-year-old man during a narcotics deal. Richard L. Davis III, who was wanted by police in connection with an unrelated battery case at the time of his arrest for the shooting, is being held in the Macon County Jail on $105,000 bond. He is due in court for a preliminary hearing on July 22nd. A Decatur police affidavit said Davis shot the victim in the torso during an altercation in a vehicle in the 900 block of West Center Street on June 21st during a dispute over a small amount of mushrooms. The victim was treated at Decatur Memorial Hospital for a life-threatening injury, then transferred to Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A witness associated with the shooting victim said Davis brandished a gun and attempted to rob the 23-year-old man. Davis told police the victim brandished a handgun first before Davis shot him with his gun. In his other case, Davis pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor count of battery and was sentenced to 1 year conditional discharge for punching a man in the face in a store parking lot on April 19, 2014. The victim also suffered bite wounds on his leg when Davis directed his Australian Shepherd to attack him. An arrest warrant was issued May 1, 2015, when Davis failed to appear in court for a review hearing. County Board to consider more money for juror fees. This is an article written by Ryan Boyles, H&R staff writer. The continuing issue of juror pay has the Macon County Board set to make additional contributions to help Macon County Circuit Court. The Board is prepared to vote on a resolution tonight that will allot $80,000 to the Circuit Clerk's General Fund to go toward juror fees for the remainder of the fiscal year, which goes to November 30th. The issue has been ongoing for several months, as a new law took effect last month that requires jurors to be paid $25 for the first day and $50 for each additional day they serve. The county had previously paid $10 a day and 10 cents a mile. With the first two jury terms wrapping up last month, Circuit Clerk Lois Durbin said the two cases totaled $30,425. The trials left the jury fee budget line over by $2,410. The jury agency fund balance is about $31,000. Durbin had originally asked for $125,000 for the rest of the year, which would help to cover the cost of a new grand jury being seated this month. The grand jury will include 16 people being selected out of 40 potential candidates. Durbin said all 40 will get paid $25, but those from the current grand jury that are coming in will receive $50. In addition, the Circuit Court could have one more murder trial this fiscal year, which generally lasts at least a week. But county officials asked for the amount to be lowered to $80,000, with the idea that more money could be requested as needed. The plan unanimously passed the county's Justice and Finance Committees and was sent to the full board for consideration. In other business, the board is set to approve the purchase of 12 traffic analyzers, which are devices placed on the road to count traffic, so determinations can be made on where additional stop signs may be needed. The Highway Department currently has 8 devices, but Assistant Engineer Joe Moretti said only 3 of them work. If approved, the current 8 would be sent back and traded in on new equipment. While the devices cost $15,593, 80% of the cost will be reimbursed by the federal government, leaving the county to pay $3,100. Library Board will wait on city's next move, an article written by Allison Petty, who is also an H&R staff writer. After an impassioned discussion, Decatur Public Library board members agreed Wednesday to not withdraw from a proposal to share space with Macon County offices. Under the long-brewing deal, the board would sell the library building at 130 North Franklin Street to the Decatur Public Building Commission, which would lease space to both the library and the county. The measure seemed likely to succeed earlier this year and was approved by boards representing all three bodies, but a Decatur City Council discussion Monday cast doubt on its future. Several council members questioned whether the arrangement was a win for the city. Mayor Mike McElroy expressed support for having the city buy the library building instead. The apparent lack of support led Library Board President John Phillips to make a motion Wednesday that the library walk away from the plan entirely. "We didn't get into this to be in the midst of a battle, to be in the midst of a controversy, to have everybody sniping. We thought it'd be an easy thing that was going to save money for everybody," he said. Phillips polled members of the board's finance committee, who ultimately reached a consensus that the board would wait to see what the council decides. Other board members also weighed in, as well as new appointees Michael Sexton and Greg Ziantara, who will be sworn in at the full board meeting next week. Ziantara is the city's finance director. He said city manager Tim Gleason is seeking direction from the council and encouraged the board not to make a decision until that discussion occurs, likely in August. "What you all want is a library building that is taken care of," Ziantara said. "What the city wants is a library building that's being taken care of." Under the plan, the Building Commission would buy the library building for $3.1 million. Instead of paying the library a lump sum, the commission would essentially pay for the building by giving the library a break on its rent, keeping the rate $615,000 annually for 20 years. That amount equals the library's current cost to operate the building, including maintenance, utilities, and supplies, library officials have said. County offices would move into unused space on the library's second floor and in its annex building. The Macon County Office Building at 141 South Main Street would be sold to 101 Main Place, LLC, with the intended purpose to redevelop the building for residential use. The parties have been in negotiations for more than a year, and specifics of the proposal became public in November. Gleason assumed his position March 23rd. Several factors affect the City Council's position. Citing state law, Gleason said Monday that the city had the right of first refusal to purchase the building. The library building is recorded on city financial statements as a city asset valued at $4.1 million, even though the library board holds the deed. Also, the city still owes about $735,000 in principal of a $5.2 million general obligation bonds that were issued in 1998 and refinanced in 2010. Library officials say money was used solely to renovate the facility, while city officials contend that the funds also helped purchase it. Jim Alpe, the outgoing board president who was heavily involved in negotiations, maintained that the arrangement is good for all parties. He said the public deserves the opportunity to have the council vote on the measure. "I'm not looking for controversy by any means. I'm amazed that this seems controversial," he said. Alpey said the city is facing difficult financial times, and the library has seen nothing but flat or declining revenues for several years. Meanwhile, he expects $5 million of capital needs for the library in the next 20 years. The measure would allow the county and the library to use all of one building rather than part of two, he said. How anybody can look at this and not think that it's a win, I don't know, he said. It's really a win for the public, in my opinion. You get something better, and it costs you no more. Outgoing board member Gary Davis said the proposal represents a benefit for everybody. If the city wants to buy the building and provide the same improvements and maintenance, so be it, he said. We don't care who paves the parking lot or puts in security or lights, he said. We want our library protected over the next 20 years, whether it's the city, whether it's the county, whether it's the building commission. The name means nothing to us as trustees. We're here to protect this library. City librarian Rick Meyer agreed, but said he knows specifics of the deal with the building commission. If the city purchasing the library is a serious option, he said he'd like to know more about how that would happen. It doesn't matter to me who the landlord is. I don't have a dog in that hunt, Meyer said. But I've got one prospective landlord who has a contract for me to read, and I know exactly what we're paying for. Shelby County mulls full-time public defender, an article by Sharon Barraclough for the Herald and Review from Shelbyville. The Shelby County Board will decide in August whether to hire a full-time public defender to handle legal cases for indigent clients. Shelby County resident Judge Alan Bennett had suggested the move because of an increase in the need for a conflict public defender, a local attorney hired by the county to represent defendants when current part-time public defender Robert Swiney cannot represent them. County Board Chairman David Cruett said hiring a full-time employee would mean a salary increase from $87,000 to $117,000. The state sets the salary, and the state reimburses 2/3 of the cost, Cruett said. At least they do for now. It's an unfunded mandate. If the state stops reimbursing the cost, the statute determining salary wouldn't apply, County Clerk Jessica Fox said. The conflict public defender is a significant line item for the county budget. We've identified $200,000 in conflict expenses, Budget Committee Chairman Bruce Cannon said. State's Attorney Gina Vonderheide said hiring a full-time attorney wouldn't necessarily eliminate those costs. Certain conflicts will always exist, she said. If two people commit a crime, they're going to point the finger at each other, and you're going to need a conflict public defender. Cruett said he would ask Bennett to address the board before the vote in August. I think we need the judge to come talk to us and give us his opinion, he said. Despite the possible increased costs, Shelby County's financial picture is looking rosier than in recent past years. This year, we're back in the black by $93,000, even figuring the full-time costs into it, Cannon said. 5 years ago, we were $150,000 in the red, so we are in much better shape. We're not strong, but we're certainly in the black, and that's a good thing. Zoo crew campers get peek behind the scenes. This is an article written by Allison Petty, an H&R staff writer. Like a group of ravenous teenagers, the 10 Humboldt penguins clustered together, craning their bodies in anticipation of breakfast. They didn't mind the rain, and they didn't seem to care that the food wasn't coming from its usual source. Keeper Nicole Zinn stood by as a single-file line of 11 to 13-year-olds with gloved hands took turns tossing capelin into the penguins' angled beaks. The stand-in zookeepers were taking part in the Zoo Crew Day Camp at Scoville Zoo, a week-long experience that gives them an inside look at working in a zoo. In addition to feeding animals such as the penguins and red pandas, the campers got to design their own exhibits and work on creating a scavenger hunt that will later be offered for visitors. They're doing behind-the-scenes activities, helping out with special projects and exhibits. They get to go fishing one day. They get a lot of one-on-one time with the keepers, said Maggie Dewworth, the zoo's education and volunteer coordinator. Alice Skelly, 11, is one of the 11 campers taking part. She said she'd possibly like to work in a zoo one day, and this week has particularly enjoyed learning about the axolotl, a type of salamander. That's axolotl. It's pretty fun, Alice said of the camp. It's a great opportunity to get hands-on experience with the animals and to learn cool things about zoos. And if you're ever interested in maybe working at a zoo, different types of zoos. For Nick Hamilton, the ideal zoo career would have something to do with reptiles. He owns a 3-foot ball python named Ghost, so called for a pattern that resembles the scream mask when he's curled up. Nick enjoyed feeding the penguins and earlier this week the pelicans, but the highlight of camp so far was when a leopard gecko crawled up to his neck. "I put it there," he said, grinning and gesturing to his chest, "and it darted up me." Zoo crew and week-long camps for other age groups continue until the end of July. To register or learn more, call the zoo at 217-421-7435. Again, call the zoo at 217-421-7435. McLean County Club has been pitching horseshoes since 1959. This is an article written by Julia Evelsizer, a writer for the Lee News Service. Sounds connected to sports can be therapeutic. A bat cracking against a baseball, the clatter of 10 bowling pins being knocked down, a golf club swishing through the air. To Bob Laskowski of Normal, the best sound is the ring of metal on metal. Laskowski has been a member of the Twin City Horseshoe Club since 2001. "Pitching horseshoes gets in your blood. You just want to do it more," said Laskowski, the league's communications and publicity director. The 18-member league meets at 6:30 p.m. every Tuesday from May through September at Maxwell Park in Normal. The club began in Normal in 1959 in Fell Park and moved to Maxwell Park in 2001. The four courts in Fell Park were not nearly as nice. Now in Maxwell Park, we have 12 courts, all fenced in with proper lighting and a storage set, said Laskowski. The town of Normal funded everything and takes care of maintenance for us. Horseshoes has been played since the 2nd century, beginning in Greece and Rome as an Olympic game. As the sports grew in popularity, leagues and tournaments were started across the globe. Although it is predominantly a game played by men, the Twin City Horseshoe Club has 3 female members. In the 1920s, Laura Lanham of Bloomington won 5 U.S. Horseshoe Championships in the women's division. "We have members from other towns like Clinton, Colfax, and Pontiac. Many of us are retired, but some are still working. In the past, we've had a member as young as 15 and one as old as 88, said Laskowski. Club dues are $20 each year to pitch in the league. Those interested in joining can contact Bob Laskowski at 309-452-0585. That's 309-458-0585. Vinton Vinton Carr of Bloomington has been part of the club for 10 years and has been pitching shoes since he was young. We had pits at home growing up, and we would pitch at family reunions every year. It's something most of us in the club grew up with, said Carr. Horseshoe pitching is most similar to golf and bowling. In horseshoes, you are your own opponent, said Laskowski. When you get up there to throw the shoe, it's not like basketball, baseball, or tennis. There's nobody out there to provide a defense. While the club accepts members of all ages, it's clear that younger generations are not as familiar with the sport. We attract an older crowd because most younger people are more interested in bags and golf, said Carr. Youth today just don't get exposed to horseshoes. The club uses handicap techniques created by the National Horseshoe Pitchers Association to make the game gratifying for everyone. When two pitchers begin, 90% of the difference in average scores between them stand as a handicap. Let's say you have a pitching average of 30 points per game and I average 40, resulting in a 10-point discrepancy between us, said Carr. 90% of 10 is 9, so you would start the game with 9 points when playing against me. Women and anyone older than 70 pitch from 30 feet. Men younger than 70 pitch from 40 feet. There is a good amount of physical activity involved, said Laskowski. The shoes weigh 2 pounds. We throw 40 shoes per game, plus warm-ups, so you move a lot of steel in one evening. According to Laskowski, there are many ways to grip and throw a horseshoe, but the two basic throws are the flip and the turn. Most champions use the turn. You grip the shoe so that when it's released, it turns sideways 1 1/4 turns so the tail lines up with the stake. When using the flip technique, you grip the shoe at the back and pitch it in an arch, spinning once in the air so it comes into the pit open. Carr used to throw a flip until Laskowski recommended otherwise. Bob told me no one wins the world championships by throwing a flip, said Carr. So I went with the turn and found that it's more fun. You have better control. The pits at Maxwell Park are filled with clay instead of sand. This allows for the horseshoe to plop straight into the pit without sliding off course. Members of the club tend to the clay pits so they retain the right amount of moisture. They turn the clay over with shovels and pull covers over the pits at the end of practice. The group takes pleasure in maintaining the pitches as well as friendships throughout the season. We enjoy being around each other and visiting, said Laskowski. At the end of the year, we have a banquet and all the spouses join us for dinner and awards. It's an enjoyable endeavor for us. First gig bands together aspiring rock and rollers. This is an article written by Danette Beckett, an H&R staff writer. Sixth grader Aaliyah Woods has sung with the honor choir on many occasions at her school, but like many budding singers, she prefers to be on stage singing with a rock and roll band. With one or two singers, people can hear us better, she said. In honor choir, there's too many people singing. Over the week, Woods and other young musicians were given the opportunity to learn what it is like to be a rock and roll star at the first gig rock and roll camp for kids at Eisenhower High School. Youth ages 10 to 17 worked with about 20 local musicians to understand the makings of a rock band. This isn't just guitar lessons, said first gig administrator Mikey Schoenemann. It's how to be in a band. The professionals explained the importance of communication with band members and management. How to work as a team, he said. How to rehearse, scheduling, marketing, merchandising, and how to practice. The students were grouped into bands with courses limited to vocals, guitar, bass, and drums. The first order of business was to pick their band's names. And you get some really interesting band names, Shuneman said. Throughout the week, the students attended workshops about songwriting, the recording process, booking, and managing. We are discussing the inner workings of a group and putting all the pieces together, said band director Chris Loresh. It is a slow process, but by the end of the week, it will all come together. The students also selected songs that are considered crowd-pleasing rock songs. Something that's got a good tempo, is recognizable and not too difficult, Loresh said. The bands will perform their songs for an audience at 1 p.m. Saturday, July 11th, in the Eisenhower High School Auditorium. The public is invited. A $5 donation is requested. After the show, the bands will be selling their merchandise, which will include t-shirts and a compilation CD. This is the second year for the Camp in Decatur. The original first gig started in Danville 4 years ago. Madison Loresh attended the camp last year as a student. She was given the opportunity to learn bass as well as sing. After the first gig camp, the Argenta Orienta High School junior was asked to join a band as their lead vocalist. We've been playing around town for almost a year, she said. I learned a lot about stage presence with the bass. Although her father is a musician, she learned on her own the thrill of being on stage. I felt comfortable enough by the end of the week to stand in front of an audience, Madison said. As soon as you play the first chord, all the fear drains. First-time campers are hoping to feel that thrill as well. Tyler Bell watched his brother's excitement after last year's first gig. To prepare himself for this year's camp, Bell received a guitar and has been practicing ever since. I thought that was the greatest thing to play a guitar, he said. As a quick reminder of upcoming events, Sunday, July 12th from 6 to 7 p.m., the Decatur Municipal Band will be playing at the Fairview Park Pavilion in Decatur, and that repeats every week on Sundays until Sunday, August 17th. So make a note, I'm not sure, the weather is looking a little iffy in the morning on Sunday, but hopefully it will dry up enough for the concert there at 6 that evening. So make a note on your calendars. We're going to take a quick break. And then we'll return for the second half hour of news from the Decatur area. So hang in there. I'll be right back.